I was telling you last week when I went through the topic of Joshua and some of the parallels that are in the time of his marching in the leadership of the Israelites when they circled Jericho and took down Jericho, or God took down Jericho. And I told you I'd made that travel from Jerusalem on down the hills to Jericho in that long trek. And I mentioned I'd gotten a few souvenirs from that trip, some unspent ammo and so forth. But in that summer of 1970, I came away with a few other examples of Israel's land and what it brings forth. And this is one of them. This is a pot from the late 600s to 700 A.D. This is about 1,200 then years old, 1,300 years old. It's the handle of a pot that would be used to store grain. It would have been rather large, and it would have had one of these on each side. And Mr. Turnipseed, do you want to come get this for me? Just walk it around the congregation. If anybody wants to touch it, they can, that they'll then be blessed forever. Since it's from the Holy Land, so. But as you look at it, it's Omayyadian, and for what interest that is to you, there are four families that came from Muhammad and that formed the Islamic faith, and the Omayyads were one of those princely families. And the Omayyadians took much of North Africa, went across where the Gibraltar Straits are, took Spain, and they came back and they settled in the area of Israel and were a founding and large controlling family after Muhammad died in Jerusalem. So that's called Omayyadian as far as the date goes, or dating it by a period. And if you look at it, you'll notice that it's unglazed on the inside. And if you look real carefully, you'll see that there's two layers of clay. And I don't understand that, but you can see that there's two different types of clay in the pot. But you can imagine it would be very heavy when filled with grain, and people would take it. And I guess maybe one guy tried to pick it up and wasn't big enough, and it fell, and he broke it, and I found the handle in a shred pile. And I said, well, I'm going to take this home. Now, that was one of the things that I brought back. And it leads me to the title of my sermon, Pots and Vessels. And I bring that as an example of a type of pot. And there's other kinds of pots. We've got another pot or vessel here. You've mostly seen these at home. We've got some in the garage. This has held feet at the time of Passover for washing. It's held dishes. Mostly it's held shells. My wife is a sheller. She collects seashells. And to dress them properly, she washes them and sorts them. And she has some of these bins when she's doing that work. And she soaks them in here, and depending on what wee beastie's in the shell, there might be even some other stuff in here with it. She knows how to operate and disembowel a shell, so I'll not get into that. But she knows all. She's quite excellent in the anatomy of the people that live inside shells. So this is another kind of vessel that we have. I was talking with Mike Fike, and he, of course, found out I'm from Wyoming, and he says, you know, my wife and I spent almost a week in Kelly, Wyoming. I couldn't believe it. I know Kelly, Wyoming. It's one street wide, and the post office is on that street, and there's not much there, and they'd spent some time there relaxing and enjoying Kelly, and I asked him about a particular family I know in Kelly. They hadn't met them. And then across, just across Gros Ventre River is a large ranch owned by a friend of mine, or it was his. He's now sold it, I believe. And these things were kind of a unique crossing of paths. But anyhow, when I used to vacation up there and take kids up there during the summer for a summer experience, sometimes I would do things, and sometimes I got an award. And this is one of the awards I got up in Kelly, Wyoming. I was born in Torrington, Wyoming, and that milk can says Torrington, Wyoming Co-op on it. And when I first saw it, it was a mess. It was rusted in. He presented it to me, and it was kind of funny. Well, Joy brought, and I brought it home too, and she took it down to Loveland, Colorado, where we lived, and took it to a plating house, and she had it plated with nickel. And so it weighs a little bit now. And if you ever want to pick that up, I won't ask you to carry that around. But if it were filled with milk, it's a chore to carry. You really would become a farm boy if you were carrying those very, very far, very often. So that's another type of vessel. And 10 gallons of milk in there, or cream, it's sizable. So I'm talking a little bit about pots and vessels, and all of these illustrations, I hope you can see how they weave into this topic today. It's somewhat inductive. You might not know where I'm going until the very end. So if you lose me, you probably won't get the conclusion. So you got to stay awake today. God gave specific instructions to the Israelites about the temple service and how they should use the pots and vessels there. The religious service was to be done in a very clear-cut, precise, and yet really simple way. In Exodus 38 is one of many scriptures that you could turn to. This one has to do with the setting up of the temple service in the tabernacle tent. And let this serve as our singular example of using the tabernacle tent service, religious service, and what it says in 38:1 of Exodus. And he made the altar of burnt offering of shittim wood. 5 cubits was the length thereof, and 5 cubits was the breadth thereof. It was 4 square, and 3 cubits the height thereof. So it was basically the size of a short cube. 5 by 5 by 3. A cubit being usually 18 to 20 inches in the way that we would think about it today, without being specific and knowing exactly which cubit. But that would be the size of it. And I was telling the people over in St. Petersburg this morning that some of you will remember seeing those little cars go around called the cube. Well, it'd be about that size, but I saw a cube the other day, had a bumper sticker on it. It said my other car is a circle. So I don't know if you drive a circle or not. He made the horns thereof as the 4 corners of the horns that were of the same, and he overlaid it with brass. So the horns are overlaid with brass. And he made all the vessels of the altar, the pots, the shovels, the basins, the flesh hooks, the fire pans, all the vessels thereof he made of brass. Now most of your Bibles will say brass, but indeed brass as you and I know it wasn't being used until about 200 years ago. The brass that we know is an alloy that requires pure zinc. And pure zinc wasn't found, or wasn't able to be refined, until about, 1850 or so. Or was it 1750? Anyhow, it's a recent discovery in the subject of these kinds of things. Here, I'll take it. I want to be holy too. But the back to the story then of these metals. Really, when it says brass, a better or the best translation would be copper. And copper is readily found in the Middle East, especially in the land of Israel. And if you're aware of copper, sometimes you'll find it right on the ground in its purest form in areas that yield copper. Sometimes volcanic activity has melted enough of the rock that you'll find a small amount of squiggly kind of looking stuff that is pure native copper. And then when you have pure native copper, you can see that some force has brought it forward, because it takes a fire or a melting a melt point of about 1980 degrees Fahrenheit. So you start thinking that these people were smelting copper, and what were they using for fuel in the desert? What kind of a bellows had they figured out to make? What kind of vessels were they using to smelt the copper in, so they could then pour it out and then they could work it into a sheet? Copper is fairly malleable. And then move it around a horn, or make it into dishes like are mentioned here, the various pots and vessels. So just considering that, and maybe for what it's worth, gold can be smelted at about the same temperature. So if sometimes when you're reading about gold in the Bible, you can think about that too. Now, an example from the time of the temple and the art crafts of the temple, we can turn to 2 Chronicles 4. And you'll find very similar thoughts from the tabernacle's instruments of care concerning the temple's instruments and the pots and vessels there. Hiram made the pots, 2 Chronicles 4, verse 11. He made the pots and the shovels and the basins. He finished the work that he was to make for King Solomon for the house of God. He made two pillars and the pommels and the chapiters, which we would consider the capitals of the pillars. He made all of these things, 400 pomegranates on the two wreaths, two rows of pomegranates on each wreath to cover the two pommels of the capitals which were upon the pillars. Pomegranates were often used by the Israelites and instructed so by God that they would use the pomegranate, because in a pomegranate there are hundreds of seeds, right? And God said that he's going to make Israel as the sands of the seashore. And there will be many, many seeds then to provide that. And so it's a type of us understanding what God intended for Israel. 14, he made also bases and lavers, which made he upon the bases. And he made one sea, or one large dish, that was held up by 12 oxen that were put together in the artisan of the crafts of the day. The pots also, and the shovels, and the flesh hooks, and all their instruments did Hiram make for King Solomon for the house of the Lord, made them of bright brass. So the copper that was used could be polished, and they polished and maintained it. Now, when they did these things, and you start to read, as we read together here, about some of the offerings, and it says they were polished, how did they keep all of this stuff clean? How did they keep it all clean? Let's look in Leviticus now, chapter 7. As they tell us about the peace offering. Leviticus 7:28. The peace offering gave instructions about, here there are instructions about it, and how that they were to be a boiled offering. And it was an indication of a good, healthy relationship between the offerer and God, and the offerer and the priests. So it was a peace offering between God, the priest, and the person doing the offering. And everybody was at peace, fellow citizens, and so forth. Leviticus 7:28. And the Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the children of Israel, saying, He that offers the sacrifice of his peace offerings to the Lord shall bring his oblation to the Lord of the sacrifice of his peace offerings. His own hand shall bring the offering." So it's something that you've decided to do, made by fire. "The fat with the breast, it shall be something that he brings. The breast may be waved for a wave offering before the Lord." So you heave up the breast or the fore part of the animal and you wave it before God. So if it's a large animal, the priest would have had to be very strong to wave it back and forth. And he says in 31, "He shall burn the fat upon the altar, but the breast shall be Aaron's and his sons'." And so the peace offering they get, the Aaronic priesthood enjoys, "And the right shoulder shall you give unto the priest for a heave offering of the sacrifices of your peace offering. He among the sons of Aaron that offers the blood of the peace offerings and the fat shall have the right shoulder for his part." So the right shoulder for the wave breast and the heave shoulder have I taken of the children of Israel from off the sacrifices of the peace offerings, and I give them to Aaron the priest and to his sons by a statute forever. So what was waved and then was put in the pot and boiled, put in the vessel and made done by boiling water, was to be given to the priesthood. Now today, kosher food laws still dominate the Jewish society. For a little comic relief, you might just check the Hebrew National commercial. And if you listen to it or see it, it says no ifs, ands, or buts, double T-S. It's because they don't use the hind quarters of the animals when they make their products. They only use the front half of the animal. And that's why a bone-in rib steak is so highly sought after. You know, that's one of the tastiest and most enjoyable pieces of meat. Highly recommended as good eating. So we see that the priesthood would use these large pots to boil the meat in from the peace offering. And so while everything is designed in the tabernacle tent and in the temple, and all of these things are made, they're put to use as well. Now in Leviticus chapter 10, starting in Leviticus 10, just a few pages over, verse 10 is a very important verse, but we're going to start with 12. "And Moses spoke to Aaron and to Eleazar and to Ithamar, his sons that were left. He says, take the meat offering that remains of the offerings of the Lord made by fire and eat it without leaven beside the altar, for it is most holy. You shall eat it in the holy place because it is due and it is your son's due." So what had been reserved for the Aaronic priesthood and his families, it goes on down to these priests. "And the wave breast," verse 14, "and the heave shoulder shall you eat in a clean place, you and your sons and your daughters with you, for they find this as their due, and your sons do, which are given out of the sacrifices of the peace offerings for the children of Israel. The heave shoulder and the wave breast shall they bring with offerings made by fire of the fat to wave it for a wave offering before the Lord. And it shall be yours and your sons with you, a statute forever." Now, so we see how it was to be done and how it was to be handled and eaten. But then when we turn to 1 Samuel chapter 2, we find that the sons of Eli, and you remember that Eli was then given the charge to look after Samuel as a young boy, and he grew up in that environment of the priesthood and learned of those things. Well, that priest, Eli, also had two sons, and he says in verse 12, "Now the sons of Eli were sons of Belial. They knew not the Lord." So if you wonder what the definition of Belial is, it's not knowing God. In other words, it is knowing Satan. It's a very, disingenuous service that they did. So 1 Samuel 2 and now verse 13. And the priest's custom with the people was that when any man offered sacrifice, the priest's servant would come while the flesh was in seething or when it was boiling, and with a flesh hook of three teeth, again use this copper instrument, in his hand, he stuck it into the pan or the kettle or the cauldron or pot. All that the flesh hook brought up, the priest took for himself. So they did in Shiloh, that's where we were reading first, unto all the Israelites that came there. And before they burnt the fat, the priest's servant came and said to the man that sacrificed, give flesh to roast for the priest, for he will not have boiled flesh of you, but raw. And so the priest's servant didn't follow that instruction. The priest said, I want you to go get me a piece of that shoulder, a piece of that prime rib roast before it's cooked. I want it raw because I want to roast it myself. I don't want it boiled. I want it for myself the way I want it. And the world is filled with people following the great I. And 16, and if any man says, let them not fail to burn the fat presently, then take as much of the soul as your soul desires, that he would answer him, no, but you shall give it to me now. If the priest would try to redirect him, he says, no, I want it now. And if not, I will take it by force. Wherefore the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord, for men abhorred the offering of the Lord. See, it was more than just a pot or a vessel made out of copper. It was the offering in the pot that was important. And there's some parallels that you can consider as you might think about this through the week. But all of these scriptures give background for us today. It's a very old question. Sometimes it might be considered a useless question. But the question that I want to frame the rest of the sermon around is, why does the Bible say, do not boil a kid in its mother's milk? And that would be the SPS for the sermon. Why does the Bible say, don't boil a kid in its mother's milk? I've read to you how God wanted the offerings given and how the instruments that were to be used were be designed and made in a fashionable way. And as they made them, they were then instructed to do them again for the temple service in Jerusalem. I've read to you how the priests, the sons of Eli, were not genuine in following that injunction. But all along the way, we find three, and it's unique that it is three scriptures that we can read that say, You should not see the boil a kid in its mother's milk. Because meat was to be boiled, it says. Exodus 23, verse 19. The first of the first fruits of the land you shall bring into the house of the Lord your God. You shall not see the kid in his mother's milk. Then, a few chapters later, Exodus 34, verse 26. Almost identical. The first of the first fruits of the land you shall bring unto the house of the Lord your God. You shall not seethe a kid in his mother's milk. And then there's Deuteronomy 14, verse 21. You shall not eat anything that dies of itself. Give it to the stranger that is in your gates, that he can eat it, or you can sell it to an alien. You are a holy people unto the Lord your God. You shall not seethe a kid in his mother's milk. Says it three times. Yet we've been reading that God does talk about boiling meat for the sacrifice. What does it mean, don't boil a kid in its mother's milk? Now, the Jewish view of these things, because they are the keepers of the Hebrew Testament, have developed Talmudic law, and in their reading of these three scriptures, which all are identical, it tells them to keep milk and meat products separate. That's how they employ the knowledge of these three verses. So that if you have a milk product and also a dairy product and a meat product, you do not keep them together. You do not serve them together. In the strictest fashion of Orthodox Judaism, you would not even take and ingest them within the same 8-hour period. If you had a hamburger for lunch, it could not be a cheeseburger. And you would have to wait till 8 p.m. till you ate your cheese. Or if you ate a cheese sandwich at lunch, you couldn't have ground meat until 8 o'clock the next night, or that night. They use separate dishes for their preparation. And sometimes I've heard of how an Orthodox household will have two sets of dishes, two kitchens. In fact, when it comes to cleaning up the soiled dinnerware and dirty dishes, they would have make sure that they were not washed together. Because to them, this says, you should not have meat and milk together. In these three scriptures, it talks about boiling a kid, so you then have meat, and mother's milk, so then you have a dairy product. They should not be put together. That's how it is rendered in their thinking. Well, what does it mean? And is there something important for us to know? And I think that you'll see that there is something to fill the purpose in these scriptures that sometimes has not easily been considered. Now, the Biblical Archaeology Review, in its 6 months production each year, in the fall production in 2008, had an article written by a young lady who was an anthropologist and traveled around in the Middle East. And in her studies, she thought she had found part of the reason why the Jewish people followed this injunction and why it was something that was told to all of Israel. Because in her travels, she found that there were a lot of people who followed the customs from generation to generation, in fact, for hundreds of years, of how they would feed their families. They made one particular dish where they would roast or cook grain, put it in a pan, and then in a large jar, large vessel, they would grow a culture of yogurt. And the yogurt would get thick. And then they'd pour it into the pan over the grain. Then they'd cut it into cubes, and this was their daily staple. It was a dairy product with a grain product. But they also had a large vessel that was glazed as compared to the unglazed vessel that they used to produce their yogurt. The glazed one, they would put in meat and onions, garlics, leeks, wine, I don't know what all, and they would boil it. And because it was in a glazed pot, just like a crock pot, it was able to be cooked and enjoyed that way. Where the unglazed pot that they grew the yogurt in was never washed, and in the cavities, the small crevices, the little spots inside that unglazed pot, the bacteria of the yogurt was kept and refined and refined and refined, and it was never washed, so that was always kept. And it was then a culture that they could pass down. And as said in her article, the Biblical Archaeological Review, that any young woman who found herself becoming a bride and great-grandma or grandma was no longer making yogurt because she was eating now her daughter's yogurt and her daughter's roast, if she got the pots that her grandma had had, it was significant because she didn't have to take time to grow the kind of enzymes in the yogurt pot, nor did she have to worry about finding a glazed pot to cook her meat. It was something that they enjoyed doing, and it was it's a very simple culture. She found a lot of people on the island of Crete that herd sheep doing this, and the sheep and goats provided them with what they wanted to put into the yogurt pot or to the meat pot. And she thought that this was important because she became aware that once in a while somebody would be in a hurry, the yogurt pot was gone, empty, they had people coming over, so they would put meat into the yogurt pot and try to make a dish. But because the enzymes that were in the crevices of the unglazed pot were there, it would sour the meat. And it would spoil everything about the unglazed pot. The meat was sour, the juices were sour, and it's kind of like the time when you were just a young kid. Mom says, well, get some cereal, that's okay, and you went to the fridge, got that bottle of milk that had this much left, you poured it on your cereal, and it, it's sour. And so then you found the good milk, and you try to add it to the sour milk. Does it work? Never works. No amount of fresh, sweet milk will change the taste of sour milk. You just make more sour milk. So what they had to do on the island of Crete when this happened was to take that pot that had been spoiled because meat had been cooked in it, that unglazed pot, and they had to refire it for 12 hours in a hot oven to kill everything. And then the poor lady would have to start all over with a new genesis of yogurt culture. And she thought, well, that's probably why they were talking about this. Now, there are some analogies that are pregnant in all of that when you learn how that happens, because fire and cleansing and how you put something that is clean into something that is dirty, it won't preserve it. Everything becomes tainted. However, we do find, going to Genesis 18, the first eight verses, that perhaps what the Jewish Talmudic tradition had been teaching about not mixing dairy products with meat products was just simply the way of man and wasn't the way of God. Because in that scripture, in Genesis 18, the first eight verses, Abraham serves dairy product and meat product at the same time to the Lord. Let's look at Genesis 18, the first eight verses. And the Lord appeared unto him in the plains of Mamre, and he sat in the tent door in the heat of the day. He lifted up his eyes and looked, and lo, three men stood by him, and when he saw them, he ran to meet them from the tent door and bowed himself towards the ground. And he said, my Lord, if now I have found favor in your eyes, pass not away. Let a little water, I pray you, be fetched. Wash your feet, rest yourselves. I'll fetch a morsel of bread and comfort your hearts so that you can pass on and you'll be refreshed. And so they said, well, let's do that then. So Abraham, verse 6, went to the tent of Sarah and said, make ready, quick, three measures of fine meal. Knead it and make cakes upon the hearth. Now, fine meal is mentioned, and I'll just mention that fine meal is made by sifting and sifting and sifting the ground flour so that you get rid of all of the bran. So what you're left with is the whitest of whitest flours. And that is what they used in the offering and making of the cakes in the temple service. And so if you enjoy donuts made out of white, white flour, there's your biblical opportunity. and he didn't make cakes upon the hearth. 7, and Abraham ran to the herd, caught a calf, tender and good, gave it to a young man, he dressed it, and they took butter and milk and the calf, which he had dressed, and set it before them, and stood by them under the tree, and they did eat. They ate dairy product and meat products together. And so while there are these three references that tell us don't boil a kid in its mother's milk, Abraham did mix those two items. So the Talmudic tradition is not right. A Jewish philosopher of about 1,000 years ago, a very educated man named Maimonides, explained that in the region where Israel was, in that Middle East, in the Fertile Crescent, there was a tradition amongst the pagans. The pagans would take a young kid, slaughter it and dress it, and boil it in the milk of the mother, and that boiled milk would be spread on a field so that it would become more productive the next year. If you look into various journals that have biblical explanation, you'll find this. It certainly is in the Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown commentary. It's in Clark's commentary and a few other biblical study books that you will find. Well, Maimonides really wasn't real sure that that was it, but he thought that was it. And since then, there have been various archaeologists that have found clay tablets that verify that was the teaching of the time. And so while he suggested such was the case, indeed it's been proved that was the case. In Isaiah 55, the first two verses, talks about how one would store milk and wine and grain. We jump forward to a futuristic time in Isaiah 55, the coming kingdom of God. It says, everyone that thirsts, come to the waters. If you don't have money and you can't buy and eat, come anyhow. Come, buy wine and milk without money and without price. Why do you spend money for that which is not bread, and you labor for that which doesn't satisfy? Listen diligently unto me, and eat not that, and eat that which is good, and let your soul delight itself in fatness. When we look around life today, we have needs. You have varying needs. I have needs. Some of them are wants. Some of them are extremely necessary just for the sake of survival. Some of us have needs that are that important. In the kingdom, all that we need will be supplied, and it will be free. And I don't think he's really interested in making sure that our jar is full of honey. Thank you, Dusty, for the honey today, by the way. We all thank you. He isn't concerned that our fridge has a milk jug in there, or that we've got some good bread made by the local bakery. That isn't what he's talking about. He's saying there's going to be a time comes when everything you want and desire to have to sustain you will be there, but what you really want and need and desire is spiritual. Because you've put your mind into a relationship with your Creator. This verse leads us to understand that sometimes when God is talking about the needs that we have in life, and he uses terms that are physical in nature, and food items are an example of that, we need to move ourselves forward and see that we're looking towards the future and the coming kingdom. The Israelites came to wilderness of, and it was called the wilderness of sin, in Exodus 16, verse 1. Just as they're moving out of the straits of slavery, and they take their journey from Elam, we find that they're consumed with their own survival, their own nutrition, wanting to have so much. And so in the wilderness of sin, they sin. They took their journey and all the congregation of Israel unto the wilderness. And on the 15th day of the second month, so this would have been right after the second Passover, after departing out of the land of Egypt, the whole congregation of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said, "Would to God we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots, and we did eat bread to the full. You brought us here into the wilderness to kill us, this whole assembly, with hunger." Then said the Lord to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, that the people shall go out and gather a certain rate every day, and that I might prove them, whether they will walk in my law or not." So there is the promise that he's going to do something about their complaining, but they're most consumed with having that flesh. And if you think back to those three scriptures, don't boil a kid in its mother's milk, one becomes consumed with, when can I eat meat? When can I eat cheese? And that isn't the point of God's instruction. At the end of this chapter, 16, looking at 21, Exodus 16:21. "And they gathered it every morning according to his eating, and when the sun waxed hot, it melted. And it came to pass that on the sixth day they gathered twice as much bread, 2 omers for one man, and all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. And he said unto them, 'This is that which the Lord has said, tomorrow is the rest of the holy Sabbath unto the Lord. Bake that which you will bake today, and seethe, or boil what you will seethe. That which remains up, lay up for you to be kept until the morning.'" Now, I've told you before, it's okay to eat donuts. This is the origin of the bagel. They boiled the dough of the... it's where they started bagels. That and those lovely dumplings that we of German heritage know all about. You can go 2 miles on a stomach of dumplings. Anyhow, they ate those, and it says that they found that it didn't destroy, so it's okay to keep a bagel and eat it the next morning, is what it's saying. For going on down 29, "And see, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. He gives you on the sixth day the bread of 2 days. Abide every man in his place. Let no man go out of the place on the seventh day." So the people rested on the seventh day, and the house of Israel called the name thereof manna. It was like a coriander seed, white, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. So we find God does have an interest in taking care of us physically, but it seems that mankind, every time there's some instruction, focuses so much on the physical, he loses sight of the spiritual. In 2 Chronicles, we were there before, but over now in chapter 35, in verse 10. "So the service was prepared, and the priests stood in their place, and the Levites in their courses, according to the king's commandment. And they killed the Passover, and the priests sprinkled the blood from their hands, and the Levites flayed them. And they removed the burnt offerings that they might give according to the divisions of the families of the people to offer unto the Lord, as it is written in the book of Moses. And so they did with the oxen. And they roasted the Passover with fire, according to the ordinance. But the other holy offerings sawed they or boiled they in pots and in cauldrons and pans and divided them speedily among all the people. And afterward they made ready for themselves and for the priests, because the priests, the sons of Aaron, were busied in offering of the burnt offerings and the fat until night. Therefore the Levites prepared for themselves and for the priests, the sons of Aaron. Well, these scriptures bring us, I think, full circle. And I ask you then the question, how does all of this apply to us today? I've gone through how to make sure that you make instruments of copper for the temple service, how they did that in the tabernacle tent, how they did that in the temple, how they were instructed always to use them, how the sons of Eli misused them and didn't obey the sacrificial laws and wanted to roast their own meat. How does this apply to us? Well, let's review again those three scriptures in Exodus 23, Exodus 34, and Deuteronomy 14. Let's look at those three scripture sets again. But let's see the context in which the thought is given to us, do not seethe a kid in its mother's milk. Let's look at the context. Exodus 23, starting in 14. 3 times you shall keep a feast unto me in the year. You shall keep the feast of unleavened bread. You shall eat unleavened bread 7 days as I commanded you in the time appointed of the month Abib, for in it you came out of Egypt. And none shall appear before me empty. And the feast of harvest, the first fruits of your labors, which you have sown in the field. And then there's the feast of ingathering, which is at the end of the year, which you have hastened when you have gathered in the labors out of your field. So he talks about the 3 seasons of the year. And that is lost for some. They don't see that it's talking about a year and aren't familiar with what is discussed, especially in the Hebrew language, in Genesis 1:14. As it applies to these thoughts. And then these 3 times in the year, all the males shall appear before the Lord. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread, neither shall the fat of my sacrifice remain until the morning. The first of the first fruits of the land that you shall bring into the house of the Lord your God, you shall not seethe a kid in his mother's milk. Now let's read the next one in context, Exodus 34. 6 days you shall work, but on the 7th day you shall rest. In earing time and in harvest you shall rest. And you shall observe the feast of weeks, of the first fruits of the wheat harvest, and the feast of ingathering at the year's end. 3 times in the year shall all your men, children, appear before the Lord God, the God of Israel. For I will cast out the nations before you and enlarge your borders. Neither shall any man desire the land when you go up to before the Lord to appear there. When you're there for the fall holy days, don't worry. People may look at your land, but I'll protect it, he says. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leaven. Neither shall the sacrifice of the feast of the Passover be left unto the morning. The first of the first fruits of your land you shall bring unto the house of the Lord your God. You shall not seethe a kid in his mother's milk. Now in these 2 that I've read with you so far, do you see how they work together? What these scriptures are telling us in Exodus in these 2 locations is that we should keep the holy days and forget about anything that is pagan and vain and not be absorbed with it. And so while people find that they're more concerned with the milk or the dairy products and the meat products and whether or not they should eat this or that, the very people that are given the opportunity and the privilege to maintain the Hebrew Testament for us overlook the fact that the holy days are the central trunk that should be kept. Now, as I said, it might be insignificant to you that these scriptures are there about seething a kid in its mother's milk. But the ways of paganism are everywhere. And he's telling the Israelites, avoid the ways of paganism. Keep the days that I have given to you. Follow my instructions. And sometimes, for the sake of his people as they were in Israel of that time, he was very specific on how to use the tools made out of copper. Now, the third scripture in Deuteronomy 14, let's read the context there. I read to you just 25 before, but let's look at 14, verses 21 through 27 of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 14, 21. You shall not eat of anything that dies of itself. You shall give it to the stranger that is in your gates, that he may eat it, or you may sell it to an alien. You are holy unto the Lord your God. You shall not seethe a kid in his mother's milk, but you shall truly tithe all the increase of your seed that the field brings forth year by year. And you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he shall choose, where he places his name, the tithe of your corn, wine, oil, firstlings of your herds and flocks, and learn to fear the Lord your God always. Mixing dairy and meat has nothing to do with fearing God. And if the way be too long for you so that you are not able to carry it or go from that place with it, then you shall turn it into money, bind it in your hand, and go to the place that God has chosen, and bestow that money for whatever your soul desires, for oxen, for sheep, for wine, for strong drink, whatever your soul desires. And you shall eat thereof before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household, and the Levite that is within your gates. You shall not forsake him, that, for he has no part, no inheritance with you. We need to be very understanding in our lives that sometimes people get things so far out of context, they forget about what they should be doing, and that can happen to us. In Matthew 23, Christ cautions the hypocrites of the time that in their tithing, they're very absorbed with the tithe of the mint, anise, and cumin seeds. Cumin seeds, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 for me, 1 for God. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I kid my daughter, a pharmacist. Only thing you have to be to become a pharmacist, be able to count to 30. She tells me there's more to it than that. But these Pharisees and scribes, hypocrites, have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. These you ought to have done and not left the others undone. You blind guides which strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you make clean the outside of the cup and of the platter, but within you are full of extortion and excess. You blind Pharisees, cleanse first that which is in the cup and platter, that the outside of them may be clean also. In Mark chapter 7, the Pharisees find fault with the disciples because they're eating with unwashed hands, or unwashed hands. I've been reading the King James too long. Mark 7, here in verse 1. Then came together the Pharisees and certain of the scribes which came from Jerusalem. And when they saw some of his disciples eat bread with defiled, that is to say, unwashed hands, they found fault. For the Jews and all the Pharisees, except they wash their hands often, do not eat, holding the tradition of the elders. And when they came from the market, except they wash, and they eat not, and many other things there they do, which they have received to hold, as washing of cups, plates, copper vessels, and even how they wash the tabletop. Then the Pharisees and scribes asked, "Why walk not your disciples according to the tradition of the elders, but eat bread with unwashed hands?" And he answered and said, "Well, Isaiah the prophet has said of you, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men.'" As we grow up and mature in these ways of God, be very concerned about your relationship with Him, that He sees that you are most concerned with His commandments, with His instructions, and that whatever traditions you seem to have inherited and things that people learn from these or that other sources, and sees that they're not really growth-oriented. They have nothing to do with salvation. The foundation of the Lord is indeed firm. Concluding a couple of thoughts here that we find in 2 Timothy 2, verse 20. "In a great house there are many, there are not only vessels of gold and of silver, but also of wood and of earth, some to honor and some to dishonor." 2 Timothy 2:21 now, "If a man therefore purges himself from these, he shall be a vessel unto honor, sanctified and meet for the master's use, and prepared unto every good work." You see, the problem is we're not always purging, and there is then dishonor. And dishonored vessels will not be used by God in His opportunities for the coming kingdom. God's feasts and how we keep those feasts, the times that we keep them, are not a tradition of men. They were not invented by men. They are the commandments and instructions of God. The scriptures about boiling a kid in its mother's milk, it's not about eating rules. It's about your spiritual diet, and making sure you're not following anything that is false or even close to paganism. I thought of these things in conclusion. We all need pots and vessels. We all need trash cans. We all need something to boil water in. But our lesson is to remember it isn't the physical pot or vessel that is important to God. It's what is put into the vessel. Now, you are a vessel for God. And anatomically, sometimes, even in God's Word, He talks about our sexual parts as vessels. And we would not put those into anything that is putrid or would give us disease. What do we put into our minds that would disease our minds? He desires us to know that He is our caregiver, that we are His vessels, and He pours into us His Spirit, as we understood from the sermonette. He provides us a way. And He talks about relationships like father and son, brother, sister. He talks about weddings and marriages, heirs, brides, children. That's what He's putting His attention to. So love those relationships just like you were living them with Christ beside you. For indeed He is. And as we develop within our human vessel the godly character of the kingdom, take the opportunity to pour it where you can as salt and light. And don't worry about the opportunities that someone might say, "Well, don't eat this cheese now for 8 hours because you just had a slice of beef." That isn't where it's at. You're moving towards the kingdom. Refuse anything that is not right. Always do that. Now, as you go out this week, because I've told you that, someone's going to try to push your button. Just remember, this week when someone is out there pushing your button and you're finding the test or the temptation, don't go there. It has nothing to do with the kingdom, and you're all about the kingdom.